Be seated. Well, it is great to be back with you after our little time away. And it was good to be away, but it is even better actually to be back and to be with you. I think we all felt that as we sort of came back into Edmonton, that it's just great to be coming back to this community and to you, our people. And so it is great to be back with you. How many of you know what your name means? Does anybody want to venture to tell me what their name means? Beloved. David. Beloved. Margo. Somebody shout it to me.
Pearl.
Pearl. Amazing. Carol.
Song of joy.
Fountain of joy?
Song
of joy. Song of joy. Oh yeah, I guess that would make sense, wouldn't it? What we sing every Christmas. Yeah. Does anyone know what my name means? I have an unusual name in most circles, although it seems that Mennonites in Canada seem to use it a little more than other groups of people around the world, because I have encountered several Myrons. In fact, there is another Myron Penner. Did you know this? Has anyone, if you Google me, especially Google image me, image search on Myron Penner, my name will come up, my face will come up along with that of my doppelganger. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time revealing his identity, but there is someone else in Western Canada who has a PhD in philosophy with the same specialization as me, the same interests as me, and is an evangelical Christian, and we actually applied for the same job at one point. And he looks so close to me that I have been told that I have been accused of well, maybe not accused is too strong a word, where I met someone who had run into this person beforehand and said, I thought you told me you weren't the right Myron Penner that I was meeting. And I was like, what are you talking about? And well, I talked to you earlier and you said you weren't the right Myron. And I was like, you weren't talking to me, pal. So anyways, but I have this name that's unusual, and it's been a source of ambiguity for me for quite a while. Since I can remember, actually, because I actually am a namesake. I'm named for someone else. And it was actually kind of a bittersweet kind of story where my parents were in what was used to be called missionary internship as they were going off to the mission field. And there was another couple who they became incredibly close with who had a little boy who was blonde-haired and blue-eyed named Myron. And my mom was pregnant with me. And as it turned out, these people went away to the mission field, and this son was very tragically killed in an accident. And it devastated my parents. And my mother said, if I have a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy, my hair used to be blonde when I had it when I was younger, I will name him Myron. So I thought, well, that's pretty cool to be a namesake. And I've always had a special relationship with the people who were the parents who are still alive and around today. And it's a special thing. But as I got older and I discovered what my name meant, I didn't like it at all. So no one knows what my name means. Well, that's great. I don't need to tell you. No, I'm just kidding. Myron is a Greek word, and it actually is the substance from which myrrh comes. And so it means a sweet-smelling fragrance, quite literally. And it also is deeply associated and connected with things that are holy, because fragrance and incense was something that you used in the holy place. And so in the Hebrew usage of this word, of this name, it became associated with the holy place. But I didn't know that when I was younger. I just knew it meant sweet-smelling fragrance. And I don't know if you've ever been on a playground with young boys. It's just not very cool to be the sweet-smelling fragrance one. And so, you know, it sort of ran against what I wanted to be. I thought it gave me this image of somebody who was just wimpy, not very masculine. And so I was embarrassed, and I kind of struggled with that name. And actually, I used to get teased a little bit by some of my friends. And not in an incredibly mean spirit, but enough that I really didn't like it. And so we have this story today from our Old Testament that I want to focus on. And I'm actually going to focus on that and sort of just one layer of that story, because that story is just so incredibly rich. I mean, there's so many layers to this story, but I won't be able to get into all of them. But as we look at this story, there is actually something quite profound, I think, that we come out of it with. And here's the thing I want you to keep with you as you go. And we're going to come back to it, and hopefully this will make even more sense after I'm done. But I want us to remember that the people of God are those who know God and are known by God in and through our struggle with God, who struggles for us. So we've got this interesting story, and it sort of jumps right into the action. But of course, this story is part of a much, much bigger story. And as we get into this part of the story of Jacob, the account of Jacob, as it said at the beginning of our reading, this is the account of Jacob. Jacob is going to receive a new name, but it's really interesting circumstances. You see, he is on the run. He is on the run from his brother Esau. And why is he running from his brother Esau? Because his brother Esau is pretty mad at him. Well, why is he mad at him? Well, we read a few weeks ago the part of the story where Esau sells his birthright, or he's actually tricked out of his birthright by a scheming, conniving Jacob, who sort of finagles the situation so he gets what is properly his brother's. And so he's heard word. Well, first of all, he's been hiding from his brother by living with Laban. At least that's one way to look at it. He's been under the security of Laban, but then he actually kind of tricks Laban, and he's able to make peace with Laban. And now, he just as soon as he's made peace with Laban, another one of his schemes has come to roost, and his brother Esau is sending 400 men towards him. Now, that's obviously not in the part that we read, but it's just in the verses preceding it. And of course, he's very distraught, and it says, I think in verse 7 in our chapter, that he is greatly distressed. He's filled with anxiety because he knows of his vulnerability. And so this is the point at which, well, then he also, then this is important, he turns to God. And he's already met God, and God has already passed on to him a promise, a covenant. And he reminds God of that, and he says, "Save me from my brother Esau." But he's got a plan on how that's going to work, which is never a bad idea. And so he has just split up his family. He sends them across the river Jabbok, which, by the way, I wish I had time to get into all of the interesting levels, but all of the major words in here are in Hebrew word plays, because Jabbok is also close to Jacob, and they mean struggle and Israel and all of that stuff. It's quite fascinating. But the core of this story is a struggle. And Joseph is in a struggle with his brother for a birthright, for a blessing. So he split this off, and then all of a sudden in the story, with zero introduction whatsoever, this person, this man shows up and starts to wrestle with him. It's like, it's bizarre. We don't know anything about this person. We don't know why he's fighting with Jacob, and we don't know what started this struggle at all, except that Jacob gets locked in a deep, deep struggle. A wrestling match. Did anyone ever wrestle? Like, seriously wrestle? Wrestling is one of the most exhausting things you can do. At university, I did judo, which is essentially wrestling with big clothes on. But I'm sure some of you wrestled as a kid, but it's just exhausting. And here these two go at it, and the story gives us no indication of who this is. And it's sort of like we get to sort of experience the bizarreness of this story and this encounter in exactly the same way that Jacob does, because he doesn't know the end of the story. He just knows here's this guy. And there's some kind of threat or something We just don't know. We don't know if he was trying to block Jacob's way. We just don't know what's happening. But this man engages him in a desperate struggle. And so they are locked in this struggle, and it goes on and it goes on, and the man can't best Jacob. He can't get it over on him. And then at some point, and the Hebrew word is interesting because it's a bit ambiguous, he touches him, he strikes him, he does something to him, to Jacob, and his hip is thrown out of joint. But Jacob is tenacious enough that he hangs on to the man and won't let him go. In judo, you have these ways of getting points, and if you get someone into a hold and you can hold them for so long, you get a quarter point, and if you keep going, you get a half a point, and if you do it long enough, you'll get a full point, which ends the match. And I remember being in this one match, and I was fighting this guy who was three belts ahead of me because I was just a novice. And I got him, and I held on, and I held on, and he was digging his elbows into me and doing everything, and I just held on. So when I hear Jacob holds on to him, it's like I know exactly what he's doing. I was just holding on. It didn't matter what happened. Well, that's what Jacob's doing. He's hanging on to this man, and he will not let him go, and the man starts to get a bit nervous or something. He says, daybreak is almost here. And he will see this person's face. Of course, they're wrestling prior to electricity, so it's been pitch dark. So he doesn't know who this person is. He's never seen this person's face. This is all part of the mystery. And Jacob will not let him go until he blesses him. This, I think, is one of the supreme virtues of Jacob, is that he pursues the blessing of God with everything that he has, all of his resources. However misguided he is, what he really, really desires is the thing that only God can give. And so the man and him are locked, and he says, unless you bless me, I won't let you go. And so he gives him a new name, and in that moment, Jacob starts to realize, or who knows at what moment, maybe it was a progressive thing, but after that he realizes who it is that he's struggling with. And he says, tell me your name. And the man refuses. And he answers a question with a question, why do you want to know my name? And he goes ahead and blesses him and gives him a new name. But Jacob's never the same again, and he walks away. There's this image that I had while Renee was reading of him limping off towards the promised land. He gets to go free, but he never knows exactly what this person's face is. And he never finds out the name, but he knows that he has come face to face with God. And yet he has lived. So there's a couple of things I want to sort of highlight as we go through this, and I think they're all leading us to this point that I was talking about before, that the people of God, because remember, he is renamed Israel, and everyone after him becomes those who are the children of Israel. They are the Israelites. So the people of God are those who know God and are known by God in and through their struggles with God, who struggles for us. You see, we've kind of lost the sense of what a name is, but a name was absolutely critical. I was going to say to ancient cultures, but pretty much to every other culture than ours, because indigenous peoples around the world still find it really important that you have a name. And of course, one of the things about names is that they're intimately connected to our identities. And we kind of disconnect those things, but at the same time, we can't quite get away from it. And names are actually things, and identities are actually things that we can't fashion for ourselves directly. Like, I can try to tell you, I did this once actually, tell you what to call me, but unless you decide to call me that, I'm not going to be called that. I tried to get away from my name when I was in junior high because I just decided Myron's not cool enough. I'm going to go by my middle name, and I started telling people to call me Bradley, and they're like, no, you're Myron. You're Myron. I didn't choose the name. My parents chose it for me, and that's my name. I actually hope now, as an older person, that I can live into what my name really means. But in the ancient world, names were incredibly important. You see, these cultures understood the world to be what we might call enchanted. But what it means is that they understood that there are powers at work in reality, that there are spirits. And to know the name of something, whether it's a person or even an object or a spirit or a power, was somehow to gain some measure of power over that thing, because you could call it, you could summon it, and you could maybe even through sacrifices obligate it to you. And you just think of stories like this, right? Like with genies and things like that, where you can get power by knowing over someone by knowing their name. And so Jacob wants to know the name of this mysterious man. And he wants to do it, I think the implication is, so that he can gain some kind of power over him and he can be a Jacob. What does Jacob mean? The schemer. So that he can leverage power in some way over this person to get from him what he wants, or get what he wants. But notice that this mysterious person, who later on becomes identified with God himself, demonstrates his power over Jacob in at least two ways, by showing him, first of all, he knows his name. He knows he's the schemer, the struggler. But even more importantly, he changed Jacob's name from Jacob the schemer to Israel, which is itself ambiguous, because it means, if you look this up, you'll find a lot of different, very similar but slightly differently nuanced versions of what this name means. One of the most accepted is God fights, or he struggles, or he strives. You see, Jacob has been a schemer, a manipulator. He's been marshaling his resources and leveraging his power to outsmart everyone around him to get an advantage. So he's been attempting to win the blessing of God for himself, by himself. But this new name is a double entendre. God fights. That's ambiguous. Who is God fighting? Another way to interpret that, by the way, is God rules. But is ruling over or for? Is he fighting against or with or for? See, in English, prepositions really mean a lot, right? They change everything. Change the position of the subject. So God struggles. I think there's two senses in which this Israel means two different things at the same time. It means God struggles with us, but it also means that God struggles for us. And so from here on, the name Israel will always be identified with Jacob's struggle with this person, the one who struggles with God, but the one for whom God struggles, the one whom God rules over in the struggle. You see, the people of God are those who know God and are known by God in and through their struggle with God, who nevertheless struggles for us. The people of God are those who will not let God go because they know there's nowhere else to get the blessing. It's like Peter. Remember when Jesus takes a look at them, his disciples, and he says, so are you going to leave too, as the crowds were leaving? And Peter throws up his hands and says, where else are we going to go? You alone have the words of life. See, the name Israel means that God has redeemed Jacob's struggles. His struggles with God and his struggles with humans. In verse 28, I know you have struggled with God and with other humans, and you have overcome.
It's that tenacity, that holding on, that continuous perseverance and struggle. You see, what happens to Jacob in all of this is that he realizes that his struggles with Esau are really, first of all, a struggle with his own schemes, with himself. And in this encounter with this man who is God, as he comes face to face with God, he recognizes who he really is and who God really is. That God is the source of everything that he's been striving for, and he therefore will not let him go, no matter what. And what's significant as we look at the rest of the story is we never see Jacob again resorting to deceit as the way that he will get his blessing and get his own way. From here on, he's different. And from this point on, he places his relationship with God above his personal gain. And so what we see here is that Jacob meets God and is never the same again. You see, in the middle of dealing with his crisis with his brother, a crisis that he generated through his schemes, Jacob must first deal with God and deal with his own self before he deals with Esau. It's interesting that in the story, the blessing is never said what it is. It's the name that changed that's different. And because he's different, things just are fine with Esau. Jacob has asked God for help and he's begged God to be faithful, but God responds not by dealing with Esau, but by dealing with Jacob. And even though Jacob thinks he's striving against Esau and against this opposition that's coming to him from around him, in reality, he finds out he's really struggling with God, and God shows him that he's really struggling with himself. And Jacob must come to the end of himself and exhaust his abilities and resources that enable him to scheme and to secure and strive. And then he sees the face of God. So Jacob doesn't leave this encounter unscathed. He's forever changed. He's been given a new name. He's no longer a schemer. He's the one who is in a struggle and who has given over to be struggled for by God. But he also limps his way off to the promised land. You see, Jacob's wholeness depends on his acknowledging his need of God and his new identity as one of God's children. It includes his weakness, his brokenness, his limp. And that is his strength. You see, my struggle to accept my name is really a very insignificant comparison to Jacob's whole situation. But I think somehow it's at least a little bit like, it's kind of like a metaphor. And it certainly is a metaphor for how I can struggle with God to accept my identity in Jesus Christ. I don't like my weakness. I don't like my limitations. I certainly don't like the brokenness that happens in my life and because of me. And I scheme, and I try to satisfy myself apart from God far too often. But I need to know that the people of God are those who know God in and through their struggles and are known by God in that same way, and that God actually is the one who struggles for us. C.S. Lewis once said in his book, The Problem of Pain, in reference to the problem of pain, or the existence of pain, that God whispers to us in our pleasures, but pain is his megaphone to rouse a deaf and dying world. I think I want to change that and modify that, and I might say this, that God whispers to us in our good times, but it is when we struggle with God in the midst of our vulnerabilities, our fears and our anxieties, that we actually discover who God is, and we're able to discover who we are and see God's face. See, at the heart of our identities in Christ is this struggle to admit our need of God and to submit to God's direction of our lives. So do you struggle with God like I do? Have you been marked by that struggle? Have you been broken? Well, each of us needs to know that each of us individually is God's child. That in Jesus Christ, we are loved and made whole, and that our real identity is with Israel. God fights for you, precisely in those darkest times when it seems that God struggles with you. See, our struggles are not in vain. Amen.